So this is the second in our four-part series on frontiers in biotechnology and halacha. This is the artificial heart, which initially, quite by accident, I came across an article that I'm going to reference in the third question by Jason Wiener on the question of turning off an artificial heart, which is the opposite end. We're going to have to start with the question of implanting one as opposed to the one of removing one or disabling one. But I found it to be a fascinating topic and thought it worth visiting. As always, not passing anything from this. I would also add that this isn't going to be comprehensive just because we have 1 hour. So there will be views that I'll just hint at or avenues that I'll just point out without actually going down with it. But the phenomenon of the total artificial heart really pushes some of our standard bioethical questions to their limit. Tests our definition for what is called death. It's a fascinating question, which I hope to spell out and to bring to the fore in the next hour. If you take a look at your sheets at the first source, but Jason Wiener is he's at a hospital in California. I'm forgetting now the name of the hospital. He's put together a very useful guide. Cedars-Sinai is the hospital. He's put together a very useful guide for halachic observance for patients in a hospital on Shabbos and the like. It's well footnoted, well researched, and I recommend it. It's available online as well. So he wrote this article that I mentioned in the beginning, Deactivating a Total Artificial Heart. And in it, in the beginning, he explains what we mean when we say a total artificial heart. Because we have to distinguish between the pacemaker, the defibrillator, or the Yor, and what we're talking about now. So, as he writes here, one common technology currently used for such patients, meaning patients with end-stage heart failure, is a ventricular assist device, or VAD, which is essentially a mechanical pump. Right, you're familiar with the basic job of the heart, right? You take blood in and you send it around the body. So a VAD is usually connected to a ventricle, chamber of the heart that pumps blood out, on one side, and the aorta, the body's main artery, on the other. So that would be a VAD. We're not talking about VAD right now. What we're talking about is the next step. A total artificial heart, TAH, on the other hand, is used for patients whose entire heart is failing. So you don't need to just replace one chamber. You need to replace the basic activities of the heart. Whereas a VAD is connected to and assists one of the ventricles, usually the left, a TAH completely replaces both of the lower ventricles and serves as a mechanical substitute for the entire heart. So in other words, like the heart isn't there. This TAH is doing the full job. A typical TAH is roughly the size of a heart that has been almost completely removed from the patient's body. A typical TAH thus differs from a VAD in that a TAH requires the removal of most of the patient's heart. Now, once you start talking like this, you have to realize what the mechanics of this operation are going to look like. Meaning the body needs the blood pumping at all times. Right? So what are you going to do? You're going to first shunt the blood flow over to a heart-lung machine, right? The heart-lung machine will duplicate the functioning of the heart as well as the lung in terms of oxygenating the blood. Then pull out whatever you need to pull out of the existing heart. Then put in this artificial device and hook it up and restart the flow of blood through this artificial heart, through the TAH that's been installed. We're clear on the mechanics of it? It matters. I'm not just saying it in order to highlight how the operation works. It's going to affect the halacha in this. This poses all sorts of really interesting questions, and especially within the view that says that life is determined to be existing or to be absent based on the functioning of the heart. Right? Meaning there is a school of thought that says brain death, the cessation of detectable neural function, that's what determines that somebody is dead. However, there is a dominant school of thought, which we're going to have to go through a little bit of, which argues that it's the heart that determines that somebody is alive. Well, then what do you do with somebody who doesn't have a heart? Right? Blood is circulating because there's a machine that's pumping it through, but he doesn't have a heart at all. So take a look at source number 2, by J. David Bleich. and this is a very important article in this discussion, artificial heart implantation. He says there are a number of practical corollaries to the theoretical question of whether or not the recipient of a mechanical heart is deemed to be a human being. Right? Meaning, if you could actually seriously ask this question of, is a person whose blood is circulated by an artificial heart, is that person considered to be a living person? Or are they just a machine that has blood flowing through it? He says that leads to all sorts of fascinating questions, such as, may the recipient's wife remarry without benefit of a get? Right? In other words, she's a widow. She's an almana. He underwent this operation. He's screaming and yelling, saying, wait, I live here. And she's off getting married to somebody else. Two, do his heirs immediately succeed to his estate? Right? Are they yorshim now? Are they heirs? They inherited. Three, if the recipient is not a human being, is he then a corpse requiring immediate burial? Oh dear. Number four, must the family immediately observe Shiva and recite Kaddish? So he says, obviously these are ridiculous. To be sure, these questions constitute a reductio ad absurdum, right? You're pushing this question, this logical idea, to its extreme in order to show how absurd it is. And evoke the intuitive reaction, the recipient is indeed a human being. Nevertheless, our intuitive response requires reasoned analysis and substantiation. That's a point he makes at greater length within the article, which is, in secular systems, if the conclusion of the law were to be, our law as it's currently designed considers this person to be dead, so the next step would be to rewrite the law, to formulate a new category, to show that, no, in fact, these people are not dead, these people are alive. But in halacha, it doesn't work that way. You don't just get to create new categories willy-nilly. Well, I guess this means that now we have to change it. It doesn't work that way. So what does this teach us about how halacha views life? So the questions that we're going to ask, the first one is just a question you have to ask as part of this conversation, although the answer is fairly straightforward. And that's, may one take the risk of receiving an artificial heart? You have a patient who's told, you could survive another couple of weeks the way you are. If we put in an artificial heart, maybe you'll survive for months and months, maybe even years, or maybe not at all. That's one question. Second question. When the doctor removes a natural heart to implant an artificial heart, is the doctor committing murder by taking out the natural heart, stopping the flow of blood from there? Third, the other end, this is where I actually started Rabbi Wiener's article. Let's say a patient is experiencing what we call brain death. The brain has ceased detectable neural function. So right now, the brain isn't doing anything. Let's make things worse. The lungs aren't operating naturally either. The person's on a ventilator that is circulating air through the body. However, the TAH is beating away, right? It's going to keep on beating until the battery runs out. So the question then you have to ask is, may you turn off the TAH? If not, what do you have to wait for? And can you bury the person? Would this thing still going inside them? I would think not. But what does that then dictate? There are a whole bunch of other questions which come up, which have come up with pacemakers and defibrillators. Questions like, would you be allowed to remove this even after the person is dead? Is that an issue of nivul hames, degrading the body? May it be reused afterwards? Will you say that you're not allowed to reuse part of a body? Right? You can't, I mean, there's a whole discussion about organ donation and so forth. Would you be allowed to reuse this for somebody else? These are pacemaker questions also. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to in this year, but I wanted to at least point it out. So the first question, is one allowed to take the risk of receiving an artificial heart? Assuming that receiving an artificial heart does not in and of itself constitute death. So is one allowed to receive an artificial heart? What would you say?
Yes.
This is really not an artificial heart question, right? This is a question of risky surgeries in general. And as a general rule, we have a principle saying that a patient with a low life expectancy is allowed to take risks for the sake of a greater life expectancy. The Shmuz Yaakov is one source for it, source number three, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, where he wrote, "Benidom kazeh, in such a case involving a patient wanting to undergo a risky procedure, kevan shevada yamus, since he's definitely going to die if you don't do it, manichan avada v'tofsin asafek ula yisrape." So you leave the definite behind, and you take the chance of a maybe. Maybe he'll get better. Hamakom ein lasos harofe kipshuta okein. However, the doctor should not simply say, okay, let's go ahead, let's do whatever procedure we think might have a chance. Rak tzarach lios matun meod bedavar. He has to be very patient with the matter. He has to consult with expert doctors, go with the majority perspective among the doctors. And he says that doesn't just mean a majority. He wants a clear majority, which he's defined as a two-thirds majority. Because you have to worry that maybe there are people who don't take things seriously, who simply jump to the conclusion of, let's do this new surgery. So therefore, you need to get a real sense from the majority, the great majority of doctors, that this is a good idea. And along with the leading sage, leading scholar of the city, and in general, the poskim on this issue, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin, who we'll quote later, Dr. Avram Steinberg, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, all of them say that in the early days, a Jew would not have been allowed to engage in such an operation. You are required to guard your life, and even if it means a minimal amount of life, you still have to guard it. Only once it became something which genuinely raised life expectancy did the balances tilt to say, okay, now we're going to allow it. Now, what would this say regarding new therapies and new procedures if everybody were Jewish? Let's say we take the view of some of the Nevi'im that in the time of Mashiach, everybody becomes a Jew. Right? Now you can't do new therapies.
Right.
Because you can't experiment on human beings, because the chances are very poor. So this is a very good question, beyond the scope of what we can answer here, but I think it's an important question that you have to ask yourself. Would you really say that you can't take such a risk for the sake of, at any rate, improving a lot of humanity, if not necessarily your own? It's a fascinating question, but it's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. Okay. So, let's move to the second question, because there's a lot more meat for us to work with. Is the doctor who removes a natural heart in order to implant an artificial heart guilty of murder? So, let me give the background on this. Why would one contend that life ends with the cessation of the functioning of the heart? So you have to start with source number 4, the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Ahalos, dealing with Tumah, says, Behema v'chaya, right, beasts, Einan mitamin, they do not communicate Tumah, ad sheteit sein afsham, until they die. What does that mean? When do they die? Hutzu rasheihem, if they've been decapitated, av apisha mefarchasim, even if there is residual nervous activity, and therefore parts of the body are still going to be jolted and moved based on whatever nerves are firing. Tamei, and they're already tamei. Kigon zanav shelatah, like the tail of a lizard. Shimefarches says it also moves after you cut it off, but it's not actually alive in any sense of things. That's the Mishnah on Ahalos, and it demonstrates the idea of death by decapitation. There are those who argue for the brain death standard based on this Mishnah, and they say, well, if a person is brain dead, then it's like they're decapitated. To which the response comes, when we talk about brain death, we talk about cessation of detectable neural function. That is not the same thing as saying the brain is dead. Meaning, you will have potentially signals from cells in different parts of the brain, even though the dominant part of the brain is not, in fact, functioning in the way that we recognize. And there's a lot of discussion about whether this actually requires dissolution of tissue, that is a physical break, like the decapitation. There's a lot that goes on within this conversation that's beyond what we're going to do right now, because this is not a shiur on brain death. But that Mishnah is the key source in the conversation. But then you take a look at the Gemara in Yuma, source number 5. The Gemara in Yuma is dealing with the issue of saving lives and violating Shabbos or violating Yom Kippur in order to do so. And they talk about a case in which, Rahmana Litzlan, somebody is in a building and the building collapses, or somebody's walking next to a building and the building collapses on Shabbos. And the rule is, of course, you break Shabbos in order to dig through the debris and save people's lives. What happens if I'm digging through the debris and I find a body, right? Let's say we knew there was only one person in the debris, and lo and behold, I found him. And I realize that even though I found the body, it's only a body, the person is dead. So at that point, do I continue digging? Shabbos. The answer is no. I have to find some way to preserve the dignity of the body. Maybe I'll bury it specifically and cover it up with something. But I don't continue digging on Shabbos, so I need to know, how do you check to see if this person is dead or alive? So that's source number 5, Gemara Numa. Tana Rabbanan, Braisa says, Ad heichan hu bodek. How far do you check on the body in order to see whether the patient is alive or not, whether this person is alive or not? Ad chotmo, to the nostril. In other words, you check for respiration, you check for breathing. V'yeshomim, and others disagree, and they say, no, ad libo, to the heart. You're checking for?
Circulation.
Heartbeat. That's the Braisa. Rav Papa comments. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa says, you have to refine your understanding of what that Braisa was doing. Machlokes mimata lamala. He says the debate of nose versus chest is specifically if you started at the lower end of the body, meaning you were digging through the rubble and you found the legs, and you're working your way up and you manage to uncover the chest and you don't find a heartbeat. So the question is it enough you didn't find a heartbeat, therefore you assume the person is dead? Or do you keep on going, unearth the head, and look for respiration? That's the they're not using CPR at this stage. That's not even a conversation in the Gemara. So Rav Papa says that in the event that you determined that there's no heartbeat, there's a debate as to whether you check for respiration. Avami malalamata, but if you unearth the head first and you found that there was no respiration, kaven debanakle achotmo, if you check to the nose and you don't find any breathing, shuv eino tzarich. You don't need to go any further. So Rav Papa says, if you find the head first and there's no respiration, that's sufficient. If you started from the legs and you found no heartbeat, then there's a machlokas. So Rabbi J. David Bleich explains that Rav Papa's view is that the heartbeat, circulation, is really what matters to define life. And he bases himself on Rashi, the second Rashi that I brought you in source number 5. This is on Rav Papa. He says, we're going to come back to the first Rashi later on. But he says, Machlokes tahanach tanoi, the debate in this Braisa is the following. Demara marad libo, mara marad chotmo. One said it's enough to check up to the chest. The other one said, no, keep on going until the nose. Milamata lamala, that's calling that when you started from the bottom and you worked your way up. Shemotz, oh, derech margolosav, chila, you found the legs first. Ubodeg vaholech, klape rosho, and then you continue to the head. Demara marbeli bo yesh lahav chinim yesh bo chiyus shenishmaso dofekes sham. Because one view says that once you're at the heart, you can tell if the patient is alive. Is there heartbeat? Umaram or ad chotmo. The other one says no to the nose. Dezimnin de'ein chiyus nikar belibo v'nikar bechotmo. Because sometimes you can't tell at the chest, but you can tell when he's breathing. In other words, the way to understand Rashi, and therefore the way to understand Rav Papa, is that your real concern is circulation. The problem is that sometimes you can't find a heartbeat. And so you should go to the nose and therefore check that way. So the first view says, the first view that in where you're checking from the legs says, and in other words, let me add in one line of explanation to make it easier. The assumption is that it's easier to find breathing than it is to find a heartbeat. If there's no breathing, you will not find a heartbeat. That's the assumption. If there's no heartbeat, though, one view says you may still find breathing, and therefore you should continue to work your way up to the head. That's the idea, is that it's easier to find respiration than there is to find heartbeat. Now,
so heartbeat's really the real criterion, but sometimes practically speaking, you wouldn't necessarily detect it.
Correct. That's exactly the way that Rabbi Bleich reads Rashi here. So if you take a look at source number 6, he says it. The necessity for examination of the nostrils is based upon the assumption that it is possible for life to exist, even though such life may be undetectable by means of examination of the chest for the presence of a heartbeat. Rashi succinctly comments that the first opinion maintains that examination of the chest is insufficient to determine whether or not life is present, quote, for at times life is not evident at the heart, but is evident at the nose. That's the end of the Rashi. By the way, Rabbi Blech's article, as well as Rabbi Wiener's article from number one, they're both available online. You can find them both online. Just take a phrase that's here and Google it, and you'll find the link to it. If you can't, let me know, and I'll be glad to send you a link. So the so this position says that life is really about heartbeat. Now, the brain deaf people will say, perhaps, at least some of them will say, that that's because they weren't aware of the functioning of the brain. They didn't have any way to detect whether the brain is functioning or not. Even if they knew what the brain does, they wouldn't have had any way to test whether the brain is functioning, so they relied on this. Had they been exposed to neuroscience, then they would have dropped all of this and said, okay, let's work with the brain. That's the argument from the brain death side. But within this view, the argument goes, you've defined life as heartbeat. Well, guess what we do when we do the surgery? We stop the heart. You're killing the patient. And indeed, Rav Unterman, and this is what I was looking for right before the shiur, Rav Unterman in volume 13 of Noam actually argues against heart transplants on this basis. Not a total artificial heart. He didn't have a total artificial heart. He wrote decades ago. But he argues against it in general. And in fact, our issue is not only going to be with a total artificial heart. And our issue is not only going to be about a heart transplant. Our issue is going to be about open heart surgery in general. Years and years ago, I read the story about a heart surgeon who goes to a mechanic, and he brings in his car, and the mechanic says to him, "You know, I don't understand. You work on the heart, and I work on the engine. Why is it that you make so much more than I do?" Which in Canada may not be true. But anyway, why is it that you make so much more than I do? And the heart surgeon answers, "You know, you try working on the engine of the car while it's still running." That's his response. The point of it in the context that I saw it was a good lesson regarding tshuva. The difficulty of tshuva is working on the heart while it's still running. But in terms of the story, what the surgeon actually said was not true, because he has to stop the heart in order to be able to work on it. So, it's a good story, but it's not medically correct. Anyway, but the point here is that any time you do open heart surgery, if you are working on the heart, you have to attach it to a heart-lung machine. So this question isn't only about the TAH. This is an old question. And in fact, the fact that we undergo such... Not we, Baruch Hashem, still okay. But the fact that people undergo such surgeries all the time tells us that it's mutter. You can't tell me that it's usur, that you're not allowed to stop a heart, when thousands and thousands of these surgeries have been performed halachically. On good observant Jews, performed by good observant Jews, can be. Source number 7, Rabbi Mordechai Halperin says, Svarazu, this argument, and I added in brackets, Sheish Mitzicha Bachlafat Alev, the idea that you're killing somebody when you change the heart. He says, it is dependent on the Zmachlokis of the poskim, the halakhic debate, which we have to get to. But at the end of the first line, he says, Ach im hi mitkabelet kalacha. If we were to really accept this, if this argument were to be accepted as halacha, as lo rak hashtalat leiv adam te'aser al piha, not only would transplant of a human heart be prohibited, elagam hashtalat leiv bal chai, parentheses baboon. But he says also using a baboon heart would be aser, would be prohibited, v'chin leiv malachuti, as well as an artificial heart. But it's clear that it's not so. It's clear it's not so. And he continues after the parentheses on the third line. Read the parentheses. He says, it can't be so. Either because the law won't follow the Chacham Tzvi. We'll see the Chacham Tzvi shortly. He's the one who says that a person without a heart is dead. But either because we don't follow Chacham Tzvi, or for some other reason, but it can't be that this is the law. V'haraya lekach, and the proof of it is, kol nituchei alev ha-mesuvagim, ki nituchei lev patuach. He says all of the various forms of heart operations, like open heart surgery, behem mufsakot pi'ilut halev v'hareot, l'chalutin l'meshach shahot mispar. He says, then heart function, as well as lung function, is halted entirely for hours. And you use a heart-lung machine and so on. He says, it can't be. Yes, I understand Rav Unterman, as well as Rav Kasher, who we'll may get to later. But it just can't be. So now we have a problem. Because you're telling me it can't be that this is called killing the patient. But I don't know why. Why isn't this an issue of killing the patient? So I'm going to present three arguments. And can you come up with an argument for why it's okay to do this? Why is it okay to stop a patient's heart in the course of an operation if you believe that cessation of heartbeat is actually death? Why is this not a problem of killing the patient? So one argument will be because it's reversible. Maybe when we say that when the heart stops, the patient is dead, that means that it stops irreversibly. But where it can be reversed, the patient is not dead. That's one argument. Well, I'm going to come back to that. What else?
You're containing blood flow through another means.
Good. Another argument is, it's not really about the heart. It's about blood flow. So the blood is still flowing, just, you know, through a machine. And that's a second argument in order to justify it. And then the third? Oh no! We're gonna have to talk about Tchias HaMeisim. That's not gonna help us. So we've given us approaches 2 and 3. Approach number 2 is it's not really about the heart; it's about circulation. Approach number 3 is that it's reversible. But approach number 1 is the argument that actually death is not about the heart per se. Death is about what Rabbi J. David Bleich calls vital motion, living motion, which includes the heartbeat, but is not limited to the heartbeat. And let me walk you through how he gets this very interesting idea that forget brain, forget heart, forget lungs. If some part of the body, even if it's the small intestine, is moving in a purposeful way, not like Pirkus in the Mishnah and Ahalos, but moving in a functional way, the body is still alive. And he'll include in that any cell in the brain or whatever it is, although they're not moving. But that's his argument. We have to start with the Chacham Tzvi that we mentioned before, and the case of the chicken without a heart. You've heard of this case of the chicken without the head, right? Headless Mike? Or Mike the Headless Chicken? There was a story about Mike the Headless Chicken, which apparently survived Shechita. Not Shechita per se, but survived decapitation. This is not about Mike. This is about a much older chicken. Source number 8, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi, in the Chacham Tzvi. Maisa Bariva Acha Shepascha Beten Tarnagolas. There was a young girl who opened up the belly of a chicken. Lahotzi B'nei Me'eha. She was going to take out the innards. In other words, the chicken had been shechted properly. And now she opens it up. She wants to take out the guts of the chicken. Bisvas hashulchan on the edge of the table. V'chatula charo meid lamata etzla. And there was a cat standing on the floor beside her. Omeidu mitzapa le'achoy mashi yipol arza. And it's waiting to eat whatever falls on the ground. Carnivorous cat. V'amra hariva. And the girl said, shalomatz alev b'tarnagolas. Uh-oh. She said, you know, I was pulling out the innards and I didn't find a heart. V'ima and her mother, Balata Tarnagolet, the owner of the chicken, Amra, Shema Okar Levadai Hushla Chalev La'aretz Vachla Chatul Omeid Shem Muchamach L'Nofil. What must have happened is it fell. You know, either you dropped it or whatever, but somehow it fell on the ground and the cat ate it. That's what happened to the heart. The nafkamina is, the practical application is this a kosher chicken? If it doesn't have a heart, I will argue it's a trefa. Right? It's an animal that is decidedly mortally wounded. On the other hand, there was a heart. It's just lost. So the Chacham Tzvi writes in his tshuva, I brought you one line out of his response. This goes on for several tshuvos. It's Ayin Dalet, Ayin Hey, Ayin Vav, Ayin Zayin. It's this whole long thing and a back and forth with Rivonis and Eibishitz about this case. But the Chacham Tzvi writes, Davar Barur Hu L'chol Asher Libo Lev Chacham B'Kirbo Umach B'Kad Kado. He says it is clear to anyone who has a wise heart in him, unlike the chicken, and a brain in his skull. He says it is not possible for anything in this world to live for an hour without a heart and look like a healthy creature. It can't be. There must have been a heart in this chicken. The mother is right. It must have been taken by the cat. That's his argument. Rabbi Eibishitz, in his Crazy Uplacy, on the Shulchan, in his Crazy Uplacy, he makes the statement that it's not true. He says, some other tissue must have taken the role of circulating blood. In other words, what's needed within the body of this chicken is something to circulate the blood. So, right, so there's some kind of mutation, and something else within the body succeeded in circulating the blood around the body. However, since it's not a normal heart, the chicken is a trefa. That's his argument. It's in Crazy Uplacy Simon Mem. Now, according to the Chacham Tzvi, then, removing a heart is homicide. Because he says nothing can live without a heart. And in truth, the Crazy Uplacy might agree, right? The debate between the two of them may just be how likely is it that there's something else within the chicken that mutated to be able to circulate blood. But fundamentally, if there's nothing to circulate the blood in the body, the Crazy Uplacy is going to agree this is a dead chicken. It can't be alive. But the argument from here is that the Chacham Tzvi believes that removing the heart is homicide. Or whatever, ultracide, whatever. But that's the idea. Everyone clear on that?
Yeah.
And that's where our problem comes from. However, as Rabbi Bleich shows at length, the Chacham Tzvi cannot really believe that removing the heart is homicide, because it creates problems with other areas of Jewish law. We have sources in the Gemara that indicate that there is life even after the heart is separated from the body. And I'm going to bring you two sources here. Source number 9 and source number 10. Source number 9 is a Gemara in which Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, makes the following statement. Shachar es hakone, ve'achar kach nikva hareya, ksheira. Let's say you know that there are certain wounds that render an animal a trefa, right? It can't survive. What happens if you shecht the kaneh of the animal, you shecht the trachea of the animal, and then after that, a lung gets pierced? Normally, a piercing of the lung renders the animal a trefa. But if the trachea was already severed before that happened, the lung wasn't connected to the body anymore, right? To do what? Checking lungs for things that predated the cutting. If once you do your shechita, it doesn't matter what you do to the lungs. The lung is already severed from the body. You can't make the creature a trefa. Alma, Reish Lakish says, we see from here, keman de mancha bidikula damya. Once you sever the trachea, anything hanging from the trachea is as though it's sitting in a basket. It's not in the. It's not part of the creature anymore. Clear? Now, tell me something. What is suspended from the trachea? Remember your biology. Not just the lungs.
The heart.
The heart? The heart. So that's why this is going to matter a great deal. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says, Shmami nami de Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says, you know what I learned from Reish Lakish? From this idea that when you sever the trachea, now all the things that hang from it are no longer considered to be a part of the body? Well, you know what that means? That means Mizanin Yisrael Abnei Me'ayim, Bein Mizanin Ovde Kochavim Abnei Me'ayim. You can invite Jews to eat the guts of the animal that were hanging from the trachea, but you can't invite a non-Jew to eat from it. Why? I'm going to explain it outside of source number 9, outside of the Gemara, because I think it's easier that way. Jews and non-Jews have a prohibition against Eiver Min HaChai, right? Eating something that was separate from the animal while the animal was still alive. Does that then mean, in order to shaft an animal, you have to sever two things, the trachea and the esophagus? If I cut the trachea, and then I cut the esophagus, shechita had not yet taken place until I cut the esophagus, right? So for an instant there, the trachea and everything suspended from it was Avram and Hachai, was separated from a live animal. Does that mean that all the things that hang from the trachea are not kosher? They're Avram and Hachai? I mean, I'm not one for eating lungs. But is that really true? The answer is no. Because it's Xeris HaKasav. The Torah Xeris HaKasav is a funny thing to say, because the Torah doesn't actually detail how to do shechita, it just says do shechita. But from the fact that the Torah says, shecht this, that means that once shechita is complete, those parts that you separated are kosher. Anything that was separated in the act of shechita is going to be just as kosher as the rest of the animal. That's the way it works for Jews. For a non-Jew, shechita is irrelevant. They don't have a mitzvah of eating kosher. Right? So therefore, shechita doesn't render the lungs, the heart, whatever it is, kosher for the non-Jew. For the non-Jew, it's Avram and Achai. It was separated from a live creature. That's the argument that the Gemara makes here. Are we clear on that? Somewhat clear on it?
So you're saying a non-Jew couldn't eat it?
Would not be allowed to eat it. That's the statement in the Gemara. That's Rav Acha bar Yaakov's statement. He says he's not allowed to eat it. But here's the key for us. He just told me, Rav Acha bar Yaakov just told me, that when you cut the trachea, everything that you separated is called taken from a live creature, from an hachai. But the heart's been separated from the body. It's no longer chai, it's dead. Elamai, what does that teach me?
It's not dead.
It's not dead. Even though the heart has been separated from the body is not dead. That's one proof, that separating the heart doesn't constitute death. The other argument to prove it is a much simpler case. It's in Gittin in source number 10. I think it's a Mishnah, even though I wrote Talmud Gittin 70b. It's a Mishnah. I don't remember what number. But the Mishnah there deals with a much simpler case. You have a guy who is getting killed. He wants to divorce his wife. Let's say because they don't have children and he doesn't want her to have to go to do Yibum or Chalitza. So, Shachat Bo Shnayim or Roshnayim, they cut his trachea and esophagus, or the majority, whatever. And he hinted after that, he hinted, right, to get for his wife. He can't talk anymore, they cut the trachea. But he did some meaningful sign before he died, saying that he wants to get ridden for his wife. They should write it and give it. And how long he's surviving, but evidently he's surviving long enough for them to have completed the problem. Maybe it was mostly written beforehand, and they had to fill something in, I don't know. But that's not the point. The point is, this Mishnah here in Gittin says, you can write a get for him after his trachea is severed. His heart is no longer part of the body. What does that demonstrate? That a person is still alive, even after these are separated. Now, technically, you could point out that the heart is actually not severed from the body, because it's still connected to all the blood vessels. It's still able to pump blood, right? It just doesn't have the oxygen supply. But the argument goes that this shows that the heart is separated from the body, at least in the sense that the trachea has been cut. And you told me in the Gemara that once the trachea is cut, everything suspended from it is like it's in a basket. It's no longer in the body. And the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, in source number 11, says explicitly, he says, he says, you can't say that cutting the trachea kills the creature, because look at how we do shechita. If you were to tell me that cutting the trachea killed the creature, then how would shechita ever work if you cut the trachea and then the esophagus? Right? You would be telling me that cutting the esophagus makes a dead animal kosher. In this religion, we don't believe that you can cut part of the animal and render, once it's dead, and render it kosher. It doesn't work that way. The halal, there may be such a discussion, but not in our system. So now I have to go back to the Chacham Tzvi. If you can't really believe that severing the heart's connection kills the creature, then the Chacham Tzvi is wrong. The chicken can live without a heart. So Rabbi Blaich tells you in source number 12, Rabbeinu Nissim apparently reasons that recognition that the animal has in fact not died, as evidenced by the fact that the heart continues to pump blood through the circulatory system, logically entails acceptance of the position that the heart is not already, quote, in a basket, but continues to function as an integral part of the organism. Hence, in the opinion of Rabbeinu Nissim, so long as the heart remains attached to the body and functions as the animating force of the circulatory system, it is deemed to be an integral... I think I skipped a word. I thought that I had cut and pasted this. Maybe actually retyped it. An integral part, I would think, of the body, even though it is no longer attached to the body by means of the trachea. According to Rabbeinu Nissim, the heart cannot be deemed to have been placed in a basket so long as the circulatory system is operative. So in other words, the rationale is there is vital movement within the body. Even though the trachea has been severed, things are still moving. And Rabbi Blaich argues this is actually the idea of the Chasam Sofer in source number 13. The Chasam Sofer is dealing with how you test to see whether somebody is dead. Because there was a whole controversy in the times of the Chasam Sofer. It was fascinating. The question of whether to bury immediately or not bury immediately. Do you have to wait and determine that the person is really dead or not? So Chasam Sofer writes, here's your three-part test. Kol sha'achar shemuta ke'even domim. If he is lying like a stone, a mute stone, ve'ein bo shum d'fikan, there is no heartbeat, ve'im acharach batel aneshima, and then there is no breathing, then ein lano ela divrei tarasein akdosha shum beis, then this person is dead. Three elements. No motion, no heartbeat, no breathing. That's the Chasam Sofer's standard. Where did the Chasam Sofer get this? Go back to the Rashi that I brought you on the first side in source number 5.
When you're in a coma, does you have a heartbeat?
When a person is in a coma, there is a level of neural function. And there's more to discuss about comas and vegetative states, but in brief, don't get the coma confused. But source number 5, the first Rashi there, when we talked about the guy who is stuck under the ruin, we said on Heichan Hu Bodek, how far do you check? If he looks like a dead body in that he's not moving his limbs, how far do you have to go to know the truth? But the key definition in Rashi is he's like the dead in that he doesn't move his limbs. Where did Rashi get it? Go back to source number 4, the Mishnah and Ahalos. The Mishnah and Ahalos said that there is a kind of motion that is called pirkus. That's just nerves still firing, that he doesn't consider to be life, implying that there's another type of motion, which is not pirkus, which does define life. That's how Rabbi Blech constructs the chain. It's the Mishnah and Ahalos informing the Rashi and Yuma, which in turn informs the Chasam Sofer, and which explains the Ran and then the Chacham Tzvi. The idea is that it's not about the heart per se, but rather it's about the heartbeat, which is a form of vital motion, but not the only form of vital motion, and therefore I'm allowed to do open heart surgery as long as there is still vital motion within the body. Now, I noted for you in source number 14, this is one of the things that I omitted because this wasn't going to be comprehensive. Dr. Noam Stadlan, who I think is actually Trentonian originally, I don't know why I think that, but I think he's originally Trentonian, but he's not, he's a doctor in the US, has written a couple of articles, I gave you the links here, in number 14, in which he argues against this whole vital motion idea. It's worth taking a look and reading it. I just didn't have the time within this shiur to be able to include his disagreements with the Rabbi Blaich. I'm just showing you one possible argument to permit this surgery, to permit open-heart surgery and implantation of a total artificial heart, is the argument that the body still has vital motion. The second argument is the argument that it's not really about the heart, it was never about the heart, it's actually about circulation. In source number 15, Rabbi Blaich, in a different article, proposed this idea. He says, "Sheyesh makom lomar." There is room to say, "Sha'af pe'ulat halev einasi bat achiyut mitzanatzma." Even the functioning of the heart is not actually the source of, or the reason for declaring this person alive in self. It's not inherent in a heartbeat. It's because the heart is pressing and streaming blood through the veins, through the arteries and through the veins. And life is considered to be dependent on the heartbeat only because the heartbeat is leading to these events. And as long as the heart is in fact moving, so to speak, outside the body, they know mazrim adam, and it's not streaming the blood. Chashav pirkus bialma, that will just be called pirkus. But you need the blood moving through the body. That's what, it's not about a heartbeat. It's about circulation.
Does that mean you wouldn't be able to stop CPR?
Does that mean you wouldn't be able to allow to stop CPR because your CPR is circulating the blood? It's an interesting argument. So but that's the second justification. A lot simpler than the first. Right? The first one says it's not really about the heart, it's about vital motion. The second one says it's not really about the heart, it's about circulation. The third argument, and this is going to bring us to our Tchias HaMeisim discussion, is what if the cessation is reversible? And here we get to the truly bizarre. So strap in and get ready to go with this. The Birka Yosef, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai, is the ideal person to deal with this question. He's commenting on the halacha which says that a woman is allowed to remarry if her husband dies. Right? Which we would have thought would be straightforward and about the most unchallengeable Kibbeya B'Kutcha type of law in the Gemara that everybody will agree on. But as I said, strap in, because nothing is going to be simple here. You remember the Gemara in Megillah that's quoted regarding getting drunk on Purim with Rabba and Rabbi Zera? Right? Rabba and Rabbi Zera. Rabba invites Rabbi Zera to a Purim party at his house. Rabbi Zera says, sure. And he shows up and he presumably gives him a nice present and all that. And in the course of the meal, come Rabba v'shachtel Rabbi Zera. Rabba got up and he shachted Rabbi Zera. Simple reading of the Gemara. There are many other ways to read that Gemara, but that's the read that the Chidah uses, the Birka Yosef uses. Then what happens? Rabba says, oh no, what have I done? And he brings Rabbi Zera back to life. And everybody goes home. The next year, Rabba invites Rabbi Zera to his house for the party again, and Rabbi Zera says, I'll take a pass. You don't always get miracles, right? So the Chidah asks a question. Does Rabbi Zera need to remarry his wife? He was dead. Right? He went through a period of time when he was dead, taking the Gemara to mean that he was actually dead and not the other ways that it's read. Right? Go look at the Maharsha and others for other ways to read it. So where the Birka Yosef says, V'yeshli histapik, in source number 16, there's room for doubt. Eishes Rabbi Zera, ki nishchat bala umeis, the wife of Rabbi Zera, when her husband had been killed, vadei paki kedushay, or kedushay, or kedusheha, that's why, v'hudra l'shuk, were her kedushin, her marriage, gone. Right? Dissolved. And she could now marry whoever she wanted, because Rabbi Zera was dead. When Rabbi Zera returned to life the next day, did he need to do a new marriage? Because she's a single woman. Or do we say, no, a woman is only able to remarry if her husband stays dead? Right? It sounds like a bizarre question, doesn't it? I mean, what he's asking is, what if there's a 24-hour period, give or take, between when Rabbi Zera died and when he came back to life? What if she had gotten married in the interim? That's an interesting question, though. Why didn't they bury him that day? We usually try for same-day burial. Why didn't they bury him that day? Oh, that's a good question. Okay, fine. The Birka Yosef tries to argue that a reversible death is not death, but a reversed death is not death, based on a Yerushalmi. Here's the following head-scratching case. It's a Mishnah in Gittin, which I brought you in source number 17, but I'll say it outside in the interest of time. The Mishnah says the following. A man is going overseas on business. He's worried that he disappears, so his wife won't know what happened to him, she's going to be in Aguna. So he says, let me help her out. He writes a get. He gives the get to his wife, and he says, this is your get. if I don't return in 12 months, it will be your get retroactive to now. So today is July 3rd, right? Today's July 3rd? Today's July 3rd. He gives her the get and says, in the event that he isn't back by July 2nd of next year, to get retroactive to July 3rd today. You have to do it retroactively, because otherwise if he's dead, it won't be a good get. So it has to be retroactive to now. Exactly. It's exactly that idea. Correct. So the Gemara asks a question. Let's say he did this on July 3rd. On August 1st, she gets word that her husband is dead. From reliable witnesses. The husband is bona fide dead. So now here's the question. Between August 1st and July 2nd of the next year, is she allowed to get married? Can she get married? What's the answer? You know the answer. Can she get married between August 1st and July 2nd of the next year? What's the answer?
Sure.
Why not? Why not?
He's dead.
Right. Either he's really dead, and he is really dead. So either she is a widow, right? Or at the end of the 12-month period, when he will have not shown up, it'll turn out that she's a divorcee. That's easy. The question is more complicated, though, as Rashi notes. Because the question really is a question regarding Yibum. What if the husband did not have any children? Is she able to get married now? Or do we say, you have to wait for the condition to be fulfilled? Right now, she's a widow. In, you know, next July 2nd, it will turn out that he didn't show up. And retroactive to the previous year, she will turn out to be a divorcee and therefore not subject to Yibum. Or can I argue that we consider the condition to be fulfilled because he's dead? He's not coming back within 12 months. It's over. That's the fascinating question. So the Bavli isn't sure. The Bavli is not sure what to do with this woman. And the Rambam, in fact, says, don't get married for 12 months. It's better that way. However, the Yerushalmi has a different approach. Take a look at source number 18, Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi Omer Asurali Nase. Rabbi Yossi says she may not marry. Rabbi Chagai says go ahead and get married. He's not coming back. You fulfill the condition. Rabbi Yossi says no, she's not allowed to get married. Why? Ani Omer, because I say Nasu lo nisim v'chaya. Maybe he had chias amesim. Maybe he had chias amesim and he came back to life. How do you like that argument? Maybe he came back to life. Rabbi Bleich has a fascinating side note on this. He says the Rambam is not concerned about this happening, him coming back to life. Why? Because the Rambam believes that Tchias HaMesim happens after the time of Mashiach. So you have to have Mashiach come, and then Tchias HaMesim. Rabbi Yossi, he says, perhaps sides with Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon says that Tchias HaMesim happens during the time of Mashiach. Every day we say that we expect Mashiach to come, Bechol Yom. How could you say that it's unlikely that he's going to come back to life? Of course he's going to come back to life. Tomorrow he's going to come back to life. Anyway, it's a fascinating argument. I should also note, the standard commentators on this Yerushalmi assume that Rabbi Yossi is only talking about Yibum. Right? However, it's logical to ask the question about any widow. How can a widow ever remarry? Maybe her husband came back to life. Maybe her husband is going to come back to life. How could any widow ever remarry? Right? Rav Kasher, in the 13th volume of Noam, asks this question. He doesn't have a good answer. He talks about maybe when he's buried, it's a different story. I don't know. I think it's a very interesting question. In any case, the Chida looks at this and he says, in source number 19 in his Birkei Yosef, he says, we reject Rabbi Yossi in the Bavli because his argument is unlikely to happen. But in principle, Rabbi Yossi demonstrates that if the man were to return, his marriage would survive. Right? His wife would be considered a married woman. Right? That's true. So Rabbi Bleich applies this in source number 20, and he says, similarly, when the halachically posited criteria of death, including cessation of cardiac activity, are manifest, but the patient is subsequently resuscitated, it must be assumed that the patient was not dead during the intervening interval. We're viewing this fellow, Tchias HaMesim, as having been alive all along? We assume that this man was alive all along, and he quotes from Moshe Sternbach, he quotes from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he says, thus, it is only irreversible criteria of death which establish that death has indeed occurred. You follow? So again, three reasons why this patient is not considered to be, why this surgery is not prohibited. Argument number one is, yes, you stopped the heart, but vital motion is still taking place. Which, based on those Gemaras we saw, even the Chacham Tzvi, who said that removal of the heart is death, he's still going to have to accept the concept of vital motion. The second approach is the approach that says that it's about circulation, not the heart per se. And then the third approach is, because it's reversible, that's not really called death. That's the third approach. Just like the guy who came back to life, hypothetically, his wife would not be a widow. There's a follow-up question which we're not going to do because we don't have the time for this and question number three. But I brought you sources for it. Isn't there concern that you're rendering the patient a trepha? One of the trephos is the creature doesn't have a heart. So are you rendering this person a trepha? The Tzitz Eliezer, in fact, quotes, we've shown him who say that making somebody a trepha is an act of murder.
You can't eat a person anyway, so...
It's no, but the question is, you're right. Not treif in the sense that he's not kosher. Although maybe eating a person is only the rabban. There's actually discussion about this. Gross. But anyway, but others dismiss this for a completely different reason, which is that we say regarding treifos of human beings in source number 22, the Rambam says that if the doctors can treat somebody and help cure him, he's not called a treifa. So the reversibility for humans will work to make him a non-treifa. And that's brought for Rabbi Dr. From Sofer Abraham in source number 23. He brings you the Chazon Ish on this, and he says, if we see that somebody can live, he's not a trepha. So this is not an issue. But I mentioned it as a side point because it is discussed. Rabbi Bleich has a piece on this as well in Artificial Heart Implantation, pages 82 to 86. Last question, though. If a patient's brain has seized detectable neural function, are you allowed to turn off the TAH? So here... I brought you, first of all, Moshe Isserles in source number 24. I did a funny thing here. I brought this from a source sheet of mine in a different shear. But instead of bringing you the Hebrew from it, I brought you only my translation. Usually, when I have a source from a different shear, and I'm doing a shear here, I usually just bring you the Hebrew. Instead, I only brought you the English. Go figure. But this is an issue. Let me actually, before we see 24, this was an issue also discussed with defibrillators. Whether you're allowed to remove the defibrillator when it's active but nothing else is functioning. Just I actually had a share like this when I was in the rabbinate. You had someone whose brain had hemorrhaged out the back, and there was no detectable neural function. There was nothing they could do for him, but the defibrillator, or pacemaker, whatever it was, in tandem with the pressors that were keeping circulation going in the bloodstream, were keeping this person alive, so to speak. And the question was, are you allowed to turn off this device? Do you just not replenish the pressors in the bloodstream? So that's the question here as well, except the TH doesn't need the pressors in the bloodstream. This can keep right on going, right? If you have a Duracell battery, or is it the Energizer? I forget which one. It's going to keep on going and going and going. Not to be glib about life and death, I'm sorry. But it's been a long day. But how do you view this? So one argument is like this Ramah in source number 24. The Ramah talks about the case in which somebody is a goseis. They are dying. And there's an external impediment to death, such as there's a wood chopper somewhere who's chopping wood, and the noise of it, we believe, is actually just distracting the person and keeping him alive. And he's just suffering, and he's a goseis. You can go tell the wood chopper, says the Ramah, to stop chopping wood. You'd be allowed to do that. So could I view this as being like the TAH? Can I view that as being like the wood chop, where it's something external, even though it's inside the body, but it's just keeping the goseis from dying? It's not actually giving him life. That seems to be the distinction. So Rabbi Wiener asked the Shilos on this of a prominent posium. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, who was quoted in source number 25, where you see things in parentheses, that's because it's a footnote that I just inserted into the text. But I'm going to say it outside, you have the text here. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg said, first of all, if you accept brain death, then you would be allowed to turn off the total artificial heart as soon as you can't detect neural function. That's number one, because he's already brain dead, and that's it. Number two, if you don't accept brain death, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg quotes Rav Wozner saying that if the person has a total artificial heart plus brain death, that's already sufficient to rule the patient dead, because the total artificial heart is not a natural heartbeat. That's the second half of source number 25. He asked, that was the position of Rabbi Dr. Steinberg quoting Rav Wasner. I don't know if that's Rabbi Steinberg's own position. I think he may even accept the detectable neural function in general, I think. Rav Asher Weiss says, if the patient is entirely unresponsive, then you'd be allowed to turn off the TAH. That's in source 26. Although, as Rabbi Wiener concludes, the specific guidelines and criteria for the determination are yet to be worked out. And then last, Rabbi J. David Bleich, also quoted in this article, says it's vital motion that matters. So as long as there is anything in the body that is moving spontaneously and significantly, not pirkus, but significant motion, he says even if it's just peristalsis in the small intestine, that's good enough to consider the patient alive. And until then, the patient is going to have to be treated. You are not allowed to deactivate the total artificial heart. I don't think anybody, he does quote another view from Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, but I don't think anybody says, like, you have to wait for the body to be decaying in order to be allowed to turn off the total artificial heart. I don't think anyone goes that far. But again, to sum up what we said in the last hour, number one, the risk, once you reach a better life expectancy with this surgery than without, the risk becomes something that one would be allowed to tolerate and approach the surgery. We do not call this murder when you stop the heart, even according to those who say that the heart is a definition of life. We gave three reasons why. Either because it's about vital motion as demonstrated in the Shechita discussion, or because, and the get after the person had his trachea severed. The second approach is because it's not about the heart, it's about circulation. And then the third approach is the approach that says that it's reversible, like the argument regarding the fellow who died and came back to life, when the case of Rabbi Zera, brought by the Chidah. You're also not called rendering the patient a trefa if it is reversible. And then in terms of turning off the TAH, so really the opinions vary down the line, depending on what your definition of death actually is. Shkayach, we have two more sessions in this series. One, we have...